explain. I wanted to begin this class. I wanted to explain a little history, both in and outside of ISKCON, and I'll begin with the story. And this is a story of the devotees offering Srila Prabhupada Vyasasana, his first Vyasasana in Los Angeles. And they built this beautiful Vyasasana. You know, Vyasasana is like a throne. And he was very humbled by it. And he said, "You've built this for me. I can't sit on this. I don't deserve this." That was his response. Interesting, isn't it? He actually didn't want to sit on it. And traditionally in Gaudiya Vaishnavism, such big seats were not given to the spiritual master general, at least not in what we've seen in the Gaudiya Math, that they did not have big seats. In fact, they would sit on a little cushion and give class. But the devotees, I don't know where the idea came from exactly, but the devotees wanted to offer Prabhupada this big Vyasasana, and eventually he agreed to accept it. So this was not really, as far as I understand, a traditional practice for a guru to sit on such an exalted seat. And then at some point in our movement, at some time, probably, I don't know when, 1973 or 74, 74 more likely, Srila Prabhupada introduced the Guru Puja, where we chant Sri Guru Charana Padma Kevala Bhakti Sadma, a song by Narottam Das Thakur. And that also is something which is not traditionally done, at least not in Prabhupada's spiritual master's movement of the Gaudiya Math. The Guru would be worshipped on this Vyas Puja. But in this scenario, Prabhupada was worshipped every day. He agreed to that, he accepted that, and he felt it beneficial. Also, another interesting bit of information is that in the Gaudiya Math and Prabhupada's spiritual master's movement, at the Mangalartik in the morning, they did not chant the Samsara Dava Nalalita Loka song. They chanted another song. So here in ISKCON, we have another difference in that we're chanting prayers to the spiritual master every morning. And then again, after we chant our rounds, we're doing a worship, chanting another song, but not only that, we're doing puja, which was not normally done except, as they said, on their birthday, on Vyas Puja. So there was a lot of... Prabhupada allowed there to be a lot of worship of the Guru, and of course, he is the founder Acharya, and so he was instilling or creating a foundation of his position as the Guru of the Hare Krishna movement, as Prabhupada said, his books would be the law books for the next 10,000 years. So he established his position as the founder Acharya of ISKCON, the Siksha Guru of all those who would come in the future, and that his books would be the standard law books for the next 10,000 years. And by 10,000 years, he meant that that's the prediction of Mahaprabhu, that this movement would last 10,000 years, so therefore his books would remain supreme. I want to read you something that the GBC, I just have to find it, this is what the GBC said. Srila Prabhupada is the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Maybe you don't all know who the GBC is. That's the governing body of the movement. So they posted this as a, I don't know if it was a resolution or just as an official statement. Srila Prabhupada is the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, is the preeminent guru for all members of ISKCON. All members of ISKCON for all generations are encouraged to seek shelter of Srila Prabhupada. All members of ISKCON are entitled and encouraged to have a personal relationship with Srila Prabhupada through his books, teachings, service, and his society. So, I want to explain where this came from and why I'm explaining what I'm explaining to you. Welcome Krishna Kirtan. Hopefully you can get the sound. Yeah, good. So Prabhupada set a precedent as how he was worshipped as guru. And as I said, this was not a precedent that was established, at least in the Gaudiya Math or traditionally in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. But it's something that Prabhupada really pushed. And for us, it was very important to establish this relationship with Srila Prabhupada because we did not have a lot of love or devotion for Krishna, but we had a lot of love and devotion for Prabhupada because he was there, he was Krishna's representative, he was in front of us. And Prabhupada was very expert at extracting that affection from our hearts. And so by allowing himself to be honored the way he was honored within ISKCON, it extracted more affection and more devotion, which was essential to help us. The problem, and as I said, this was not traditional, but it worked very well when Prabhupada was alive, because he was the founder acharya. And founder acharya means that everyone who comes after, who joins ISKCON, who joins any Gaudiya movement, Prabhupada will be the Siksha Guru. Generally, for everyone. Of course, in ISKCON, for everyone. He'll be everyone's Siksha Guru, and as this statement says, everyone will have a relationship with him. Intimate relationship. Even 100 generations from now, they will have an intimate relationship. Now, we have to, I don't have to, but I think it's helpful to explain some history of what happened after Prabhupada left. After Prabhupada left, it appeared to many, at least to 11 men, that he had asked them to initiate. And still to this day, some people argue that he didn't ask them, he just asked them to initiate on his behalf while he was present, and then afterwards we could all initiate. But anyway, the way it was understood then was that while Prabhupada was alive, he asked 11 people to perform the rituals of initiation on his behalf because he was very sick. Even at one point he said that they could initiate as their disciples until he got better. So the assumption was that after Prabhupada left, they would continue initiating and they would be the gurus. At least that's the assumption of some. Some just believe that they were never appointed as gurus, and he wanted that to be left open to any qualified disciple. But that's not really the issue that I'm presenting. What happened was is that Srila Prabhupada established a standard, or what we thought was the standard for guru worship, by how he lived as a guru. Another thing that Prabhupada did, or you could say didn't do, is Prabhupada, he translated, he got up every night and translated, and that was his main service. And he didn't come to the morning program. He only came to the temple for greeting of the deities in Bhagavatam class. He wasn't there in the morning for Mangal Artik and chanting his rounds with us. So, and he had his own private cooks, he had servants, secretaries, he had the best facilities. He had beautiful rooms, and it just, he was honored as God's representative on a very high level. He was the founder of Acharya. So, I'm not even on Ustream here. So, are you getting advertisements on Ustream? So, then after Prabhupada left, these 11 devotees, they discussed what they should do, and eventually they concluded that Prabhupada wanted them to initiate, and so they began initiating. Now, the difficulty was that they and many others believed that Prabhupada had set the standard for how a guru was honored and worshipped, and therefore they should be honored and worshipped like Prabhupada. And so that's what they did. And so every guru had their own seat. Every guru was worshipped every day with the guru puja. They had special facilities, living quarters, cooks, this, that, and the next thing. So what it did was it separated them from everyone else. And at that point, the everyone else predominantly was their god brothers and god sisters, except for the few that hadn't yet been initiated by Prabhupada. But the vast majority of the movement were Prabhupada disciples. And this separated them. And then, I'm not getting any ads on mine. Or maybe you can reduce the size of the window and you won't get to see the ads. So that separated them, or what also happened, another mistake that happened, was that there was some idea that Prabhupada had chosen them. And there was some idea that when you become not everybody agreed with everything, but the idea was either because Prabhupada chose them, he empowered them and they were special above everyone else, or because they're kind of the same thing, but because they're a guru, guru has special shakti or special power that others don't have. And so that these men, these devotees, were special amongst others. Like guru, when you become guru, something changes. You get special empowerment. That was the idea. So it created a lot of trouble, both for the devotees in general and for the gurus themselves, because it kind of created friction between them and many of the god brothers. It disenfranchised or alienated a lot of god brothers who didn't agree that that's what Prabhupada wanted them to do. So shortly after this happened, one devotee who was familiar with the tradition in Krishna consciousness sent out a letter and said that the guru shouldn't live this way, but they should take a more humble position, not a special position amongst their god brothers. They shouldn't have the elevated seats, the daily worship, and so forth. And it's not. We don't assume the same position as Prabhupada had because he's the founder of Acharya. But that wasn't understood well at that time because people thought, well, this is the example Prabhupada set, and we should follow that example. So what happened? This wasn't really cleared up philosophically, even though that devotee explained things according to our philosophy and according to tradition. It was cleared up when some of these gurus started having trouble breaking principles and so forth. And then it was kind of like, you know, Prabhupada tells this story, not exactly like this, and this can be seen offensive. I don't mean it to be offensive, and I'm just telling this story. I'm telling it to give you an idea. There was a jackal. I probably told this story before. There was a jackal. Jackals are like, I don't know if you've seen them. They're all over Mayapur. They're the cross between, at least they look like a cross between a wolf and a dog. And anyway, I think the story was a jackal. He fell into a vat of indigo, which is a very attractive blue color. And so he was walking in the forest, and all the animals said, "Oh, he's a god." And so he took it. "Oh, they think I'm God." So he said, "Yes, I'm God. I'm the king of the jungle. You serve me." And then what jackals do, it's very interesting. Jackals, they call one another, "Oh," like that. And one jackal calls, the other calls, and another calls. And they can't, I mean, I see this out here in Mayapur, they can't stop themselves from calling one another. So one jackal had called, and then this other jackal that fell in the blue dye, he called, and then all the animals said, "Wait a minute, he's just a jackal. You know, get out of here, you're not the king," like that. You know? So they were upset. So it was a little bit like that we had elevated these devotees far beyond their level of their status in Krishna consciousness. And then some of them started having troubles. So it was like the jackal who was elevated beyond being a jackal. And then he did his jackal calls and everybody said, wait a minute. There wasn't this special empowerment. There wasn't this. This was not the way it is. It's not. There's not this difference between all the God brothers and the one who accepted the position of guru. Oh, there may be some difference in the sense that they were some of the most elevated devotees. I'm not saying that they weren't, but not a huge difference, and not that others were not as advanced or qualified. The others that weren't giving initiation, but it developed into a situation where, at that time in ISKCON, wherever you join in the movement, you more or less just took initiation from the person in that situation. So each zone where gurus had their zones was predominantly 99% practically their disciples. So they had little kingdoms at that point, and they were very powerful within those kingdoms. And it created, it continually created problems for God brothers. And the problems continued. God brothers and God sisters kept leaving, and gurus kept falling. And devotees were starting to reevaluate the situation. And then at that point, early on, people didn't really understand the concept of Siksha Guru. It was like the Diksha Guru was the all-in-all, and anyone who was a Diksha Guru was like supposed to be head and shoulders above the crowd. And so, over time, devotees began to realize that, as we said, I think, in another class, that the position of a guru is really one who is a humble servant. It's really in the mood of serving his disciples. And not a position that puts, not a position that when one takes that service, all of a sudden they become empowered by some divine shakti that others don't have. And not that we don't honor others who also take the position of guru for us. And so I wrote a newsletter. I think it's the last newsletter. I don't know, Pallavi, if it's up on the website yet. And it's called What is Guru? And one of the things that I said in that article is that there's a verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, and it says, Acharya mam vijaniyat. You should understand the Acharya to be me. In other words, my representative, or to be as good as me because he represents me. And so there is the teaching that the guru represents Krishna, so you honor the guru as Krishna's representative. And everything that's offered to the guru, he offers to Krishna. He offers to his guru and to Krishna. So that verse is there, Acharya mam, think of the Acharya as me. So the disciple thinks, oh, I should see my Acharya, my guru, like Krishna. But the interesting thing is that and I think I may have spoken about this, in Vedic culture, many, many people are denoted as guru. So this verse, see me as the Acharya, and what you'll find in Srimad Bhagavatam, that the king is called Naradev. Dev means God and Nara means man. So it means man representing God or God on earth. The king was considered the representative of God. He represents the teachings of the Vedas. So he's like guru to the people, but in a different sense, not in the sense of instructor so much, but as more as protector and guide and one who maintains dharma. So in that sense, because Krishna's purpose is to maintain dharma, Krishna's purpose is to establish dharma and maintain dharma, so then the king also maintains dharma so that you see the king like God because he's representing him. So this Acharya mam vijaniyat, see the Acharya as me, then it extends to the king. It extends to the elders, particularly the parents, but also elder brothers. In traditional societies, in traditional Vedic societies, the mother is considered the first guru. It's not that just you respect the mother, but the mother is the first guru. So, Guru Mata. And the father also is the guru. So then you see the mother and father as representatives of Krishna. And so then we take this idea again in another direction, as we've been talking about, that anyone who teaches you, about Krishna, he's your guru. So anyone who is an authority in a sense, in the Vedic sense, represents God, and anyone who represents God is guru. So this understanding equaled things out. So it's not that someone who gave diksha holds a position that no one else can hold, only because they gave diksha. But that so many people actually hold this position of guru for us. And another interesting thing that happened, I don't know if any of you are aware of this, but another interesting thing that happened within the Hare Krishna movement was that during the time that there was overemphasis on the position of the current gurus, the worship of Prabhupada was to some degree minimized because there was so much focus on present gurus. And there was reduced focus on Srila Prabhupada. And so there was a lot of talk about bringing Prabhupada into the center, put him in the center. And it created lots of problems. And it created so many problems that the GBC actually had to pass resolutions of what gurus could and couldn't do, because they were finding that Prabhupada was being, how should we say, what's a good word? We usually would say he's being pulled out of the center, but I'll tell you some resolutions they passed. They wanted to keep Prabhupada in the center as the Siksha Guru for everyone. So they didn't want devotees walking around with T-shirts of their spiritual master, with hats with their spiritual master's picture and name, with buttons. They didn't want posters of present spiritual masters hanging in temple buildings, temple offices. They didn't want spiritual masters being addressed with honorific titles that, in public. His Divine Grace, Acharyapad, that was only for private. And so they wanted everything to be centered on Prabhupada in public. They didn't want present gurus having Vyaspuja ceremonies that were bigger than Prabhupada ceremonies, that were more elaborate than Prabhupada. So these kinds of things were happening, where gurus were dominating certain areas to the point where it was almost like it wasn't really Prabhupada as the guru, but that person as a guru. So this caused such a problem that the GBC had to pass so many resolutions to keep Prabhupada in the center. And now things are being normalized again. And what you heard in that statement I read, and what you will hear from gurus today, is more along the lines of, as your guru, I'm helping you better understand Prabhupada. I'm bringing you close. My service is to bring you closer to Prabhupada. My service is to represent him as best I can to you. And Ridhananda Maharaj once, he gave a nice talk, and he said that any one of my disciples and any one of their disciples in the future and future generations of disciples can have as intimate a relationship with Srila Prabhupada as I have. And that wasn't always so clear. But we do have this direct connection to Prabhupada. That's the way he set up ISKCON. Of course, we always go through our spiritual master, but there is Srila Prabhupada in his books, in his lectures, and in so many ways he's available. So every one of you can have an intimate relationship. And I often find out from devotees like yourself that you have dreams. You have dreams, and Srila Prabhupada speaks to you in these dreams. So that just shows the intimate connection that we all can have. So there's, of course, a lot more history that goes into that. But ISKCON has come to a healthier point now, having gone through this situation. Just recently, one of my friends told me that Ridhananda Maharaj did an initiation, and at the initiation he said, there's so many wonderful devotees, and I encourage you to take guidance from any and all of them. So this is quite a different approach than it was right after Prabhupada left. It was more of, I'm your guru and listen to me, and don't listen to anybody else. So this is more now of a family mood, that there's the brothers, the uncles, the aunties, the sisters, and we're all part of a family, and we're all being raised together. So Senia has a question. I've read somewhere in the net news gossip, probably, that some very prominent ISKCON initiating gurus were put on court and asked whether Prabhupada personally asked them to initiate disciples. And they got really angry and said, do you know anything about it? No. How does one actually become qualified according to the Shastras? How does the system of initiating, proving disciples to initiate work? What I can say is, these are things I've heard, just little sidelights, that the tradition, our tradition in Gaudiya Vaishnavism is when somebody takes sannyas, then at that point they can accept disciples. So Prabhupada told Jayapataka Maharaj, he said, you can't accept what, he said, the guru does not accept disciples in the presence of the spiritual master, but after the spiritual master leaves, he can accept disciples. Of course, sometimes the guru may authorize, he may tell the disciple, in my presence you can accept. He said, but generally, the Prabhupada told us, he said, the principle is you bring the disciples to your guru, and then after he goes, you can initiate. So that was general instruction, you can initiate. He told Bhakti Charaswami, you're a sannyasi, when you can initiate. He told Radha Govinda the same thing. He told Jayapataka Maharaj, you can initiate without limit, or initiate 50,000 disciples. So Prabhupada did give those instructions. He did say, I want all my disciples to initiate. So he didn't really discriminate between grihastha and sannyasi. We read a couple of weeks ago, all my disciples should be gurus. So that was a general instruction. And then when Prabhupada was asked, who will inherit the movement when you go? He said, all my disciples, whoever follows, they'll inherit. Who's ever the best follower, they can all do it. And Prabhupada said, you can do it also. So that was Prabhupada's general approach. So then Pollock says, in traditional Vaishnavism, there's really sannyas. So before that, sannyasis didn't initiate. Grihasthas did, because the sannyasis were traveling so much, and the grihasthas were in one place, so they could train the disciples. So in traditional Indian society, when you wanted, you could really say in traditional Indian society, that the approval of the guru, in a sense, was done by the disciple, because you can't be a guru unless you have a disciple. But your qualification for being a guru, at least one of your main qualifications, is that you're initiated by a guru in a disciplic succession. Because if your guru doesn't have a disciplic succession, then you're not connected to a disciplic succession. And the whole function of guru is to simply represent the disciplic succession. That's they're not making anything up, not creating a new religion. They're just representing the disciplic succession. That's their service. Prabhupada said that so many times. I'm like a postal peon. I'm just delivering. He said, just deliver the message. I'm delivering the message as I got it from my spiritual master, and that's why I'm successful. So then, to be a disciple, you hear from your guru, and then you deliver the message. That's the idea. So in that sense, if you're initiated by a bona fide spiritual master and you deliver the message, your qualification for being guru is that you're initiated, and that your guru has asked you to initiate, which Prabhupada asked us all to do that. And like I said, he said, do it after I leave. Now, then Sena's question was, how does becoming qualified by the Shastra? According to the Shastra, you hear from your guru, you realize, and you teach it. And so basically, we would say qualification is, you've heard, you repeat what you've heard, and you follow it. You should be a strict follower. And I would say beyond that, you should understand the heart of your spiritual master. What is his mood, the essence of his teachings? Because sometimes he may teach something, it appears to be one thing, but if you understand his heart, then you understand deeply what he's teaching, you understand deeply his mission, and then you represent that. And as I said, you have to be very careful to exemplify in your life what he's teaching. And then, if, let's say, you're not in ISKCON, let's say you're someone outside of ISKCON, you're a disciple of Prabhupada and you're outside of ISKCON, so who authorizes you to initiate? The only authorization to initiate was the order of Prabhupada to do that service. So that's your authorization. Now, if you're within ISKCON, then at this point in time in the history of ISKCON, the GBC has taken it upon themselves to monitor in some way how someone in ISKCON is allowed to initiate. And that monitoring process has changed over time to a process where it's very strictly and closely monitored and very few people are allowed to do it, to today where it's a little more open and more people are encouraged. And some devotees are hoping it'll be more open, to the point that the GBC will have very little to do with the monitoring process, and the real monitoring process will be done by the disciple, who will find a spiritual master, spend time listening to that spiritual master, perhaps being with the spiritual master, understanding their teachings, observing them, and determining if they feel that person is genuine, and not only genuine, but the right spiritual master for them. Now, interesting thing that Bhaktivinoda Thakur said in regards to this principle of in spending time, I don't know what the right word is, investigating. It doesn't sound like, I mean, that's basically what it is. It doesn't sound like the right word to use, but it's something like you're thinking about marrying a certain person, so you have to get to know them. So the language Bhaktivinoda Thakur used was not only to determine if this person is actually a qualified guru, a bona fide guru, who comes in a bona fide line, who represents a bona fide line, whose guru is bona fide, whose guru is bona fide, whose guru is bona fide, but also the compatibility. Because he felt that was important. It's not just that this guru is bona fide, but there's some compatibility. Now, from my perspective, from my realization, is that the most important thing is the sincerity of the disciple. Because there's so many gurus that are qualified to take us back to Godhead. There's so many. But what's more important is that we become qualified to receive them. So the spiritual master plants the seed, bhakti lata bija. But the seed has to grow, it has to grow in the heart. So even if the spiritual master is potent, and his seed is potent, if the soil is not fertile, it won't grow. So, but the seed of any bona fide spiritual master is powerful, and therefore it needs to be planted in the right soil, which is the sincerity, the receptivity, and the faith. It's the soil of sincerity, receptivity, and faith of the disciple. Now, here's an interesting point. which I'll bring up. It's something that you may have read or will someday read in Prabhupada's books. In one of Prabhupada's books called The Nectar of Instruction, which he said everybody should read, along with The Nectar of Devotion and Krishna book, we should read these things, these books. It said that, excuse me, it said that one should be careful to accept an Uttama Adhikari Guru. And if one doesn't accept, and one can initiate if he's not an Uttama Adhikari, Uttama means the highest devotee, he can initiate if he's not Uttama Adhikari, but he can only initiate people on his level. So this statement has created kind of, I don't want to say it's created havoc. I think in some cases it has created havoc. It's created a lot of misunderstanding. Now, I was thinking about this today, and it was really bothering me, this statement, because the way this statement is used, it's used by some to put down every disciple of Prabhupada who gives initiation and says, look, they're not Uttama Adhikaris, and therefore their guidance is insufficient. And you need to find an Uttama Adhikari Guru. And there aren't any in ISKCON, so you need to go outside of ISKCON and find them. And actually, I can recommend one. In fact, I can take you to see him. This kind of preaching, you think that I'm making this up. I'm not making this up. It would go so far as to say that actually you can't make advancement anymore because you don't have the guidance of the Uttama Adhikari. Because there aren't any Uttama Adhikaris in ISKCON. The only Uttama Adhikaris are outside. And heaven forbid your guru is a Kanishtha on the lowest level, then you're really in trouble. So, interesting way of thinking. Now, we all accept that Prabhupada is an Uttama Adhikari. And as we were saying, that the essence, we were saying earlier, the essence of accepting a guru is accepting the disciplic conclusion, accepting the siksha, the siddhanta of the sampradaya. That's the essence of it. And that essence was given to us by Srila Prabhupada, the Uttama Adhikari, and everyone is representing him. So if you are in the shelter of Prabhupada and his disciples, then you have access to unlimited siksha from Prabhupada and from people who knew Prabhupada, who were with Prabhupada, who represent what he talks. So how could that be insufficient guidance? Because isn't Prabhupada saying in this purport, I mean, you think he would be saying in this purport, when I go, even though I wrote 50 books and even though this was my main service, when I go, guidance will be insufficient. It's only sufficient now that I'm present. Because you can still approach me, although most of us couldn't, because he had so many disciples. But when I go, even though I wrote 50 books and recorded hundreds of lectures and thousands of letters, my guidance will be insufficient, and you'll need to get the guidance of a living Mahabhagavat. That's what some people believe. The real thing is, we all have the guidance of an Uttama Adhikari in Srila Prabhupada, and we have the guidance of those representing Srila Prabhupada, who may not be Uttama Adhikaris, but are representing the Uttama Adhikari, repeating the instructions of the Uttama Adhikari. So there's no lack of sufficient guidance in ISKCON. But the point I wanted to make is that the most important thing is not that is my guru an Uttama Adhikari or not? But am I, is my heart a fertile place for the guru to plant the seed? Because what is the seed he's planting? He's planting the seed that Prabhupada gave him or her. Through initiation that they receive, they're giving that same seed. Whether I give it, you give it, he gives it, she gives it, that seed is potent. So the main thing is, we have to water it with the proper instructions given from the Uttama Adhikari, Srila Prabhupada, Because Prabhupada said, unless you have initiation from Uttamadhikari, then you're not going to advance much. So we have the initiation. One time Prabhupada said, the initiation is reading my books, accepting Prabhupada in the heart. This is a different kind of initiation, not an official ceremony, but still an initiation. So Sene asked, when you said one can initiate one spiritual master is gone, meaning he's left his body or just physically absent. Tell me what I said again. Yeah. I'll try to remember what I said. It's not clear from what you wrote. One can initiate... Oh, yeah, when he's left his body, yeah. Prabhupada said... You know, he was talking about his disciples initiating, and then he said, the etiquette is that in the presence of your spiritual master, you don't initiate. And then after he leaves, you can initiate without limit. That's the law of the disciplic succession. That's what Prabhupada said. So now in ISKCON, there are spiritual masters who have many disciples and some have very good disciples, and those disciples are initiating. They've empowered them. Like the main gurus in Russia now, one is a disciple of Radhana Swami, one's a disciple of Jabhataka Maharaj. Because I don't think there are any disciples of Prabhupada in Russia, at least none that are initiating. So somebody had to do it. So that's there. When the guru gives permission, yes, you go initiate. Then you can do that. But we had discussed in the first class that Prabhupada had said that everyone should be a guru, but he wasn't referring to initiating. He was referring to instructing, because that's the main service of the spiritual master. So that's the... So you have to understand both things. And then Prabhupada said, generally, the one who instructs will be the one who initiates. Because a bond develops between guru and disciple, and then therefore one wants to formalize that bond with initiation. And initiation is considered one of the essential practices of bhakti. In the Nectar of Devotion, which we should all read, it says that one should take shelter of a spiritual master, one should take initiation, one should serve the acharya under the guidance of the guru, and one more thing one should do with the guru. There are five activities. So it's foundational, because the guru is one who guides one. And also, the guru, when you serve the guru, then Krishna's pleased, because the guru becomes God to the disciple, and how God accepts our service. And then you might ask, well, how do you know? How do I know that my guru is pleased, or how does Krishna know? Well, Krishna is in your heart, so he knows. Krishna is pleased when you serve the devotees. He knows what you're doing. He sees you doing that service, so he's pleased when you do that. So it's a principle. The guru may not even know you're serving. You may be offering prasadam, he may not know. You may be fulfilling one of his instructions, he may not know. But Krishna knows you're doing that, and Krishna's pleased that he's being served, because serving the guru is like serving Krishna. In a sense, Krishna's link, you're serving the link to him. So that's the idea. But Prabhupada said we should honor the God-brothers of our spiritual master and sisters like our guru. And even all senior devotees should be honored that way. So that's just culture. And that's why Westerners sometimes have a problem with this. You know, in cultured societies, You have many worshipable and honorable superiors. In Western society, we don't honor people that much. And we're lucky, we're fortunate enough that we'd honor Prabhupada. And we learned from Prabhupada to honor senior devotees and to honor sannyasis. And it was something a little difficult for many Westerners. Because we're not trained like that. But in any culture and society, to honor the teacher, to honor the mother, the father, the elder brother, this is all normal. And we will honor them even if sometimes we see discrepancies. That's also there in culture. You know, it's like, okay, they did this or they did that, but still, he's my brother, I honor him. She's my mother, I honor her. So that's part of a cultured society. As long as what they did is not, how should we say, it's within the parameters of respectability for that position. Sometimes it may be on the borders of respectability, but in a cultured society, you tolerate that. You don't tolerate it beyond the borders, because that would be foolish, but you tolerate it up to the borders. So, so we talked about different representatives of God, and we talked a couple weeks ago about how Prabhupada wanted all his disciples to initiate, to become gurus, or either initiate or become six-year gurus. And then we spoke a little bit today about the statement of Prabhupada's as the being, Uttama Adhikari is the only person who can initiate. But also, I've spoken about this before, but within that context, there's a misunderstanding of who is a pure devotee. You say, well, is your spiritual master a pure devotee? Well, there are different kinds of pure devotees. So what does it mean to be a pure devotee? One meaning is that anyone who serves purely. So Prabhupada would call his disciples pure devotees if they purely served. So yes, anyone serving purely can be guru. That's madhyamadhikari. So madhyamadhikari is one who's serving purely, and they can be guru. And pure service means the stage of nishta, which comes after anartha-nivritti, which means anartha-nivritti means when the anarthas are destroyed, then one is not motivated by his anarthas, and so that's a pure devotee. I'll read you something. I think I talked about this before. This is from my newsletter. Once Prabhupada was asked how many pure devotees are on the planet, he answered with the question, how many devotees are in ISKCON? He was told there are about 1,000 devotees in ISKCON. Then he said, this is how many pure devotees are on the planet. Interesting. So Nectar Devotion defines pure devotee as one who is free from any motive to gain anything material from Krishna consciousness, any motive to become free from suffering, any motive for liberation. That's a pure devotee. So if we serve without motives for material gain or spiritual emancipation, then we're pure devotees. You may say, well, Mahatma Prabhu, that's not true. No. You're not situated on the platform of pure devotional service, but you can be a pure devotee in the sense that your motives are pure. You may have impure thoughts, but your motives in serving are pure. Right? So, Senya, if you want to know how one becomes a guru in ISKCON, you can read that newsletter I wrote, the last one. You should have it, and it explains that the current process that's used in ISKCON. Now, you all probably would like to discuss something controversial and juicy, wouldn't you? Otherwise, I'm probably just putting you to sleep right now because I'm so tired. I don't know, am I putting you all to sleep? Is anyone still awake out there? Or is everyone falling asleep like me? Raise your hand if you're still awake. It's time for some juicy controversy. Oh, now everybody's going to wake up. I probably would be chastised by some of my God brothers for talking about this topic, but I always feel it's important that devotees are aware of what's going on in current society, in the current Gaudiya Vaishnava society, in current ISKCON. So, would you like to hear the controversy? It's not a big controversy, but okay. So let me explain that currently in ISKCON, if a devotee wants to accept disciples, they will inform their local GBC. The local GBC will form a committee in their local temple of 10 senior devotees who know him, and then some questions are asked of these devotees. If you know this person has any major character flaws, have done anything illegal, has had any financial indiscretions within ISKCON, do they follow the morning program, are you aware they chant 16 rounds? Oh, we're getting interrupted, the controversy is getting interrupted by a question on Ustream. Oh, okay, let's go find it. I kind of covered the chat with the chat on, I covered Ustream chat with the chat on Krishna.com. Sharon Vrindavan says, do you mean it's actually Srila Prabhupada who is taking disciples initiated in ISKCON back to Godhead? It's a joint effort. It's certainly not the guru alone who's doing it. And certainly devotees need to be initiated. Certainly devotees need to be initiated, but through their initiating, they're connecting their disciples also to Srila Prabhupada. Now, if you talk to some gurus, they will actually say straight out, I'm not taking you back to Godhead, Prabhupada's taking you back to Godhead. They will say right out, you don't make advancement by surrendering to the guru, you make advancement by learning from Prabhupada. So you can balance and adjust these things, they're both true. It just has to have to be done in certain perspective. I think we can err on either side. If you err on the side of it's all Prabhupada, then your guru becomes reduced to a position which is not in alignment with what our Shastra teaches us as a guru. If you say it's all your guru, then we obfuscate Prabhupada, and then it's all the guru, and then Prabhupada is just, he goes to the background, and then disciples, they only read their guru's books, they only hear their guru's lectures, and they don't read Prabhupada's books, and they don't hear his lectures. And so Prabhupada's a founder of Acharya, and so we're following him. And so there are many older devotees who are not initiated by Prabhupada who are fully attached to Prabhupada. It's only his books they read. It's predominantly or only his lectures they listen to. But they've been connected to Prabhupada through bona fide guru, through bona fide initiation. So it's like any way you cut it, it's good unless you go to the extreme on either side. One of the extremes that we can go to on either side is that there'll be some very elevated devotee, and then people will say, look at, he's a pure devotee. And then because he's a pure devotee, he predominates over his sishyas, his disciples, and even over others who aren't his disciples, to such a degree that the disciples become fanatical about him and think he's like the next Prabhupada. He should be the, you know, the next Acharya or the only Acharya. So then you get that. That does happen. And you definitely get that outside of ISKCON. And then you get the opposite, which is nobody's qualified to initiate, it's only Prabhupada. And even if they initiate, it's only Prabhupada. So there's a balance in the middle. I don't know if that answers your question satisfactorily. Because the point is, getting initiated is, it's necessary, it's in the scripture. So you can't avoid it. So you're going to have a guru, and you're going to have so many siksha gurus, people you listen to, and then it would be improper to deny that these people are helping you and giving you guidance. And it would be improper to deny whatever is natural in that relationship. It would be improper to not respect your Diksha Guru. But it would also be improper to minimize Prabhupada because of that. So there's a balance there. And the balance will be shifted one side or the other depending on the individual, but it shouldn't be shifted too much. That would be a problem. So let me know if your question was answered. I'm going to write something in chat to see how long it takes. If I can even get into it. I'm somehow or other, I can't even see how to write. Oh, I can say something. I'm going to ask you, did that answer your question? Oh, that went right onto chat. Wait, and it takes 8 seconds before you can read that. So, anyway, you want to get back to controversy. Controversy, that's why the news is so popular. Write something controversial. So, according to our shastras, as I said, and according to tradition, that it's up to the disciple, based on his understanding of the nature and qualification of a bona fide guru, to find one. And if he doesn't know what one is, then how will he find one? Like Prabhupada said, if you don't know what gold is, then... And you go to the jeweler, and if the jeweler knows you don't know, then they'll sell you something and tell you it's gold, but how will you know? So Prabhupada said it's your duty to know what is a bona fide spiritual master. If you make a mistake and accept a spiritual master is not bona fide, then it's your fault. You're supposed to. Or you accept a spiritual master who's not in line with your way of thinking or aspirations or something, and or in some way it doesn't work, then you're supposed to take it as, what was my mistake? I didn't check out the spiritual master. So that's what the shastra says. There are verses. Go live with your spiritual master for a year. Check him out, like that. I wrote something on the Ustream chat, not on this chat. And I was just writing something to see if the Ustream chat works, but it takes like 8 seconds before you can see it. So that's a traditional system. Sometimes a reporter would tell Prabhupada, they'd say, what about all these bad gurus? And Prabhupada would say, if he's bad, he can't be a guru. Or if he's bad, he's not guru. Then they would say, or then he would say something like, well, why are you asking me about these other gurus? And they would say something like, well, you're a genuine guru, so I wanted to ask you. And Prabhupada would say, how do you know I'm genuine? So that was always Prabhupada's point. You know, what's the standard? How do you know? It's explained in the Shastra, that's how you know. And so traditional system is, you go to the Shastra, you read Shastra and say, these are the qualifications of a guru. He's fixed in the absolute truth. He's realized it. He understands the essence of scripture. He can teach it. And so he's been initiated by a bona fide guru and he follows those instructions. Okay. And aside from that, is his mood and nature, is it compatible with me? Does he understand me? Can he help me? Do I have faith in him? Can I surrender to him? Am I willing to be guided by him? Because if I don't have faith in him, I won't be able to hear him. Right? So in that traditional system, there was no one else involved. I mean, maybe your parents were involved, your friends were involved. You say, well, what do you think? You might debate with the guru, you might question him, you might do what, you know, you do, but it wasn't, there was no committee that said, okay, these are the bona fide gurus in our village. I mean, maybe there was, if there was, I'm not aware of it. But the general system was that you would understand what a guru is and the qualifications of a guru, and then you would go check him out. So, the GBC felt that's not the way Prabhupada wanted it done, but rather he wanted them to have oversight over the process because they felt if anybody just became guru, any disciple of Prabhupada, it would create havoc, seeing that so many other gurus had difficult time and fell down and so forth. So they began developing systems, as I was explaining, the system where 10 people are asked different questions about you and they give their answers. And if you pass that with flying colors, or I don't know how flying the colors have to be, but if you get the confidence of these 10 local devotees, then it goes to the GBC body. And if no one on the GBC body objects within 6 months, then you're allowed to initiate disciples. And then on the books of the GBC, it says that we're not endorsing any of these gurus as pure devotees or not. All we're saying is that we don't find any, we don't see anything that would disqualify them, but it's your duty to check them out. And that's the duty of the disciple. So they put themselves in a position by saying we don't authorize and approve, but it's hard to say when someone goes through that process, it's hard to say they weren't authorized and approved because the process did really approve them. But they don't want it to be viewed that way because they want to say we're not approving, we're just not objecting. Which many will say, well, it's just another way of saying you're approving. But they don't want disciples to feel that just because these people have been authorized to initiate in ISKCON that you should assume that they're qualified to do so. We feel an obligation at least to do our due diligence to make sure that anyone who's initiating in ISKCON is up to a certain level of Krishna consciousness, which doesn't necessarily say anything about their qualifications to be a guru. It just says that they're up to a certain level of Krishna consciousness. So they felt it was their duty to ensure that anyone who's allowed to initiate in ISKCON is up to a certain level of Krishna consciousness. And beyond that, they just want to let everybody know that we don't endorse these people as pure devotees or anything special, and we cannot guarantee you that this person won't have trouble in the future, won't do something bad. So that's, now, there's another party of devotees who feel that it was never Prabhupada's mandate for the GBC to choose people to be gurus, but it was only the mandate of GBC to determine that this person is a member in good standing of ISKCON. They chant their rounds, they follow the regular principles. Beyond that, it's up to the disciple to choose from all those devotees that the GBC has stamped as bona fide devotees, bona fide disciples of Prabhupada. They chant their rounds, they follow the four regular principles. They don't appear to be doing anything wrong from our observation, and therefore it's now they can, you can check them out. So some people feel that that's as far as the GBC should go, because the natural system would be for the disciples to choose. So currently in ISKCON, they are involved first in the process of choosing. And I think that most devotees consider if someone's been approved. You see, the problem from the other side is they'll say that if somebody has been approved by the GBC, then you guys still see me? If someone has been approved by the GBC, then they must be bona fide. So that's the that's where some people object to, because then the disciple feels, the prospective disciple feels, well, I don't have to really check out the guru. I mean, this guru's got thousands of disciples. He's, or even if he doesn't, he's approved by the GBC. And then the GBC didn't want to really say we're approving, because they didn't want people to think that you don't have to do your due diligence because we did it. And if that guru ever has any trouble, we don't want you to think we certified him as qualified. So it's a little awkward. Because it's kind of not totally one way or the other. So some devotees feel that there's no shastric basis for that system. The GBC feels it's their ecclesiastical duty. They can't just let anybody initiate. Many temple presidents would be wary if someone, if everyone initiated, because gurus have a lot of power. So this is kind of the situation within ISKCON. But as far as we are concerned, as individuals who are looking for a spiritual master, what the movement wants to tell you is don't assume that anyone's bona fide just because they're initiating, they've been approved, or they are initiating with ISKCON. And you have to check them out. And even if they are bona fide, you have to determine which guru is best for you. And that could, there could be many considerations. Access to the person, he understands them, you have faith in him, you like serving him. Be so many things. And it's going to be different for everybody. And I can't tell you exactly what it is, because some people are happy to have a guru that has thousands of disciples and they never see him. That's not a problem. And for some people, that is a problem. So I can't tell you it's a problem for you. It should be a problem if it isn't, or if it is, it shouldn't be. That's something for you to consider. So now, did that answer your question, Senya? We probably forgot what he was asking. What was he asking? Oh, Carolyn says, what happens if the Diksha Guru doesn't want you to take shelter of a Siksha Guru? Ha ha. That's a loaded question. Okay, why do you think I'm laughing? Because that question was asked to one guru, because that devotee wanted to take shelter of the guru. And the guru said, if your guru won't let you take shelter of me, then you should reject your guru. That's why I was laughing. Sounds kind of funny, doesn't it? For a guru to say that. Okay. All right. So, okay. What's the textbook answer? I don't think that's the textbook answer. I think the textbook answer is you should do what your Diksha Guru tells you. Now, the other problem is you may have to do what your heart tells you. That's where you get into trouble. So, what if you're in a situation where, let's say, you're hearing from your spiritual master, but you kind of feel like he or she has taken you up to a certain level, and there's other devotees who can take you further, and you're really benefiting from them, and you're developing a relationship, maybe even becoming quite attached to hearing from them and taking guidance from them. And faith is developing, faith to the degree that you have with your Diksha Guru, or perhaps even more. And then your Diksha Guru says, don't. Then you have to determine at that point, is the guidance you're getting from the Siksha Guru so valuable, so important, so necessary to your Bhakti Lata Creeper that you have to maintain it at any cost? And then accept the consequences of that decision. Now, some devotees have done that. And they've accepted the consequences. These were ISKCON devotees, and the consequence was they had to leave ISKCON because they accepted a guru who was outside of ISKCON. And they accepted those consequences, and they were okay with it. Now, another answer to your question is that your guru should be happy that you're accepting the guidance and shelter of another qualified devotee, assuming that devotee is qualified. And if they're not happy, then here's the trick answer. And this is the answer that can answer this question. Well, go to your Siksha Guru and ask him what you should do. Now you're going to hear in the background windows cracking and shaking. We're getting a storm. Okay, so what are we concluding from all this? This is a very very sensitive subject. Now, general principle is one always honors their guru. And so if your Diksha Guru says, don't take shelter of this other Siksha Guru, then you have to consider that seriously. And in some cases, what devotees may end up doing is, because of the relationship with the Siksha Guru is so strong and important to them, they might have to respectfully distance themselves from their Diksha Guru and say, I respect them, I follow them, but this instruction I'm unable to follow, and I need the shelter of my Siksha Guru. For the life of my spiritual creeper. So, you know, every situation will be different. But as my joke goes, I ask your Siksha Guru what to do.